Let's start again. And the first thing I wanted to do was to go over this assignment a little bit that I handed out, just to, before even that, in the break, the issue of the fact that many of you run on Windows systems and follow the old Windows file convention. In many cases, you'll get a carriage return inserted along with a new line as the end of line terminator. Now, that's not a big problem, except that I saw one fellow that was getting a bogus error message saying that it was an unacceptable character, this being the carriage return, because we are expecting new line as white space, but not carriage return. And there are a variety of ways of doing it. You can purge out the carriage returns before you process them. I think one of the easier ways is, if you're in this context, just go ahead and make another white space character for carriage return. And it would be acting like it would have two characters instead of one. So what was somebody tell me was the escape for a carriage return? R, okay. So if you're doing that, the escape backslash R can be used. So as an adjunct to backslash new line. It's simply the case that long-standing Unix and Mac systems don't use the carriage return. Windows and I think IBM systems did. And it was one of these slight differences that wasn't enough to be fatal, but enough to really be troublesome. So if you're seeing that phenomenon, don't worry about it. It's just you got this extra character there. My test file should not have them in there. But if you do things like cut and paste, I think the underlying system is nice enough to say, oh, we're on a Windows-like system. They like to have carriage returns. We'll give you one, whether you expect it or not. If you're not sure, most editors have a way of opening up a file and including listing of unprintable characters in some form, and you can kind of see if you have them or not. And if you do, you know what's going on, but don't worry very much about it. It's not your problem as much as simply this incompatibility that's long existed. It's not enough to be fatal, but just enough to cause you needless wasted time. Well, let me get this guy back up to speed. Cool. So let me talk a little bit about the assignment and just basically what I'm looking for and not. First point is a lot of these have hand drawing or handwriting systems, so you're perfectly okay for you to write these on pencil and paper, hand them in paper, or scan them. At least one person said she'd be out of town, so just scan it and email it in, you know, in PDF or whatever it happens to be. So if you like to type, you can do it. But at least for a couple of these, you're probably going to have to draw diagrams and just go ahead and do that in what's convenient to something, as I do on my screen, but perhaps a little bit neater, simply because you'd have to be. So let me just talk about these just briefly and explain what I'm looking for here. The first one is perfectly straightforward. Many languages, including C, C++, Sharp, and Java, use /*/comments. They're fine comments. People use them. They're just a tad trickier to write down than you might expect. So this is, having had this warning, all you have to do is write down a proper comment delimited by */*/, that has the rule that individual stars and slashes may appear, but the */ combination may not appear as part of the body. So that means, for example, that this is perfectly acceptable. That's the empty comment. You can have something like, and as you've seen, many programs have that as sort of like a banner marker or something like that. So that's certainly legal. You can have individual stars or slashes like A=B*C. This might be an assignment statement that you decided to comment out for whatever reason. Or alternatively, and it's pretty easy to see what's expected. The difficult part, if it is in fact difficult, is that if you write down a fairly obvious approach, you're going to find out that it doesn't work as expected. Remember, there's one thing I warned you about. Now it would be a cool time to use it, and that's that regular expression tester I gave you. So once you think you'd have an expression that works, you look at it, scratch your head, yeah, this works, no, that doesn't, blah, 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 blah. Put it in and actually run some test programs, you know, things that should be accepted and things that should be rejected as being illegal. So if, for example, I fed that in. What should be the case is that this should match that far. But here's a case where clearly the star slash in the body terminates the body prematurely. And then the rest of this are error characters. Include that little thing that spits out illegal characters just so you know the characters were looked at and discarded. So this is not too bad, but it's just a little trickier than you might imagine. So it's an exercise in writing down non-trivial regular expressions. By the way, if you want to cheat, you can Google this, and there are dozens of solutions floating around that are perfectly valid. I'd recommend try it on your own. Maybe if at some point you're one of these things that love to look at the back of the book and check the answer. Yeah, whatever, situation there. But it's not so hard, you won't be able to do it. Just something that I think is a good thing to try out. The second one has a good solution, a good approach, and a bad approach to it. This says, draw me an automaton that accepts non-empty strings, that is strings excluding the empty string, composed of only A's and B's, so you don't have to write down too much. And the only rule is that each character must appear at least twice. So there's some element of bookkeeping. Now remember I told you a bit ago that finite automata can't count unlimited amounts. But that's not to say they can't count limited amounts. In this particular case, at least twice means that you don't have to go beyond twice. If you see 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever, that's the same thing as seeing 2. Now, the wrong way of doing this is simply start drawing states and arrows and transitions until you got something that seems to work. The right way to do it is look at those states and kind of label those almost as if you're doing a program that says, if I'm in this state, I know this information. Now, it's kind of odd because we're not used to thinking of programs as storing information not in memory, but actually in the context of where the program is. But you can actually go ahead and do that. And it exists situations that do that all the time. Later in the semester, we're going to talk about how you translate something like an if statement. This is a very common construct. You compare A against B and either execute P1 or P2. The obvious way to translate this, and the way some compilers would do it, is they would first evaluate A equals B, which is a Boolean valued expression, to a Boolean value, 0 or 1. Then do a conditional branch based on the Boolean. Turns out there's an alternative way of doing it, something called a jump code. And what jump code does is it says the way we evaluate a Boolean is not by actually putting a 0 or a 1 in a register, in a memory location, in a stack top, but rather by where we end up. 0 is false under most interpretations and 1 is true. So if this thing is equal to true, I want to be at location P1 right here, executing that part of the program. If it's false, I want to be at P2. So you can actually go ahead and by where a program is, namely here or there, is the only indication you have as to whether this computation had one value or another. We're not used to thinking that way, but in automata, you can think of these various states as knowing information. As I know something about what I've read in this state and that state and so on. And if you approach it that way, this is a fairly easy solution. And moreover, once you write it down, it becomes pretty obvious that you can't be wrong because the labeling is enough to tell you what's going on and that the specification, namely that each character must be read at least twice, maybe more, but at least that, and in any order. So, of course, you'd want to try these various inputs and verify the ones that work are accepted by your automaton and the one that don't. Number three is what the engineers back on campus call a plug and chug. That is, I've shown you some algorithms, namely, take a regular expression like that guy, translate it into a non-deterministic automaton, then run the subset algorithm and makes it deterministic, then run the optimization algorithm and makes it smaller. Well, here's something that's manageable on a sheet of paper. Why don't you go ahead and try doing it by hand and see if you can follow the algorithms well enough to do this simple determination. If you're getting trouble with the algorithms, come and see me, but it's something that if you can do this by hand, you understand the algorithms enough to say that this is not magic anymore, this is computer science. Binary strings, this is cool. Because this ties into actually what people do in practice with regular expressions and finite automata. So first of all, not all of you necessarily know about how binary numbers are represented. Many of you do, but it's something that you may or may not have seen in other classes. So we're just going to be worrying about positive binary numbers, unsigned. So these are particularly easy. It's this old notion that you can write any number you want just by using two alternatives. We routinely call them 0 or 1, and that's the heart of computer memories, computer representations. So if I can write down a number just in 0 and 1 notation, this represents a 0 or a 1. This represents something to 2. This represents a multiple 4, 8, 16, and so on. So the way binary numbers are interpreted is the rightmost digit is either a 0 or a 1 in decimal or binary. The next digit says either I have a 2 included or I don't. The next digit says I either have a 4 included or not. So this would say I have a 4 and a 2, which is 6. So this is a binary representation of 6. And I can, of course, have leading zeros, and that doesn't change anything, because that would be 0, 4, 0, 8, 16s, and so on. Many of you have seen this. If you haven't, it's a very conventional sort of notation. And it's something where is really the genius of computing is that you can represent any and all data in this form and manipulate it very conveniently. So in the old days, data were represented as magnetic settings on core memories. More recently, if you have a spinning hard drive, there's little areas on the drive that are magnetized high or low, strong magnetization or weak magnetization, that says I'm a 0 or a 1. Does anybody know? Probably you do. Let's hear about how CDs are represented or DVDs. They're not magnetized, and that's good. That means you can take a bar magnet and rub it around a CD, and assuming you don't scratch it, you're not going to be any problem. That's not true with other magnetizations. If you take a strong magnet with a hard drive, a portable hard drive, you kill it. In fact, that's how if you are going to retire your computer, what you do is you pull out the hard drive, get a super strong magnet, and magnetize the heck out of it to kill the data. So how is data stored on a CD? Right. Yeah. First of all, they steal an idea from one of my favorite movies, The Wizard of Oz. But essentially what you do is you follow the yellow brick road. So essentially what happens is on a CD, there's a spiral, just like what Dorothy takes. And actually like Dorothy, you start from the inside out. Most people don't realize that. The old style records, many of you, a few of you at least have used those. They were kind of out of date. But you've certainly seen them on the movies where you put the record on, the needle on the edge of the record and it slowly goes into the center. Well, the thing is, with DVDs and CDs, it goes the opposite direction. It goes from inside out. Can anybody tell me why they do that? It's a clever idea. What's the idea there? What's the area of the CD most likely to get messed up? The edges, because that's where you pick them up. Things like fingerprints, particularly if you got dirty fingerprints, maybe you're eating your peanut butter and jelly lunch, and you pick up one of these things, and oh, you got all the goop on it. If it turns out the thing isn't totally filled, those things aren't disturbed. So typically, it's the inner part that's most valuable. But anyway, they have the yellow brick road, and as the gentleman said, there's a laser. You all know that because, you know, the situation, there's the old style, now there's the Blu-ray, and we'll talk about that. But essentially, the little spiral, kind of like these things, has a magnetic reflective surface. You know that because you see that when you pick one up. But it's got tiny little pits burned into them, and the little bits represent one state, and the non-burned area represent another. And what happens is you shoot a laser, very, very fine, detailed laser, onto that on that spiral, and you get reflections or non-reflections. Reflections probably are a 1, and non-reflections are a 0. It could be the other way around. And that's how you store the data on CDs and DVDs. But no matter how you store it, it turns out that it's a very convenient way to store data because unlike previous media, you can have perfect representations. And part of that has to do with actual finite automata. What do I mean by perfect representations? Well, many of you have used copying machines. All of you must have. But one of the things about copying machines is they are imperfect copies. It used to be in the old days, you could copy something from a magazine, that's fine, or a newspaper. But a copy of a copy was not so good, and a copy of a copy of a copy was downright bad. Now, with modern copiers, is that still the case that you get the degradation if you copy and copy and copy second, third, fourth generations? It's probably the case. I mean, in a situation, you wouldn't expect it to be perfect. But here's the thing. With computers, it's actually possible to have perfect copies made of data, even though all these representations are inherently potentially flawed. So if I have magnetic representation, or if I have the yellow brick road dots and dashes, or bright spots and non-bright spots, it's possible to have perfect copies of the data made. And that's partially because of finite automata. Let me show you what happens. Normally, when you store data on any mechanism, it stores more data than you expected. It stores what I alluded to at the beginning of today's lecture, namely parity. So first thing I want to know is, if you give me a copy of data, is it clean or not? But let's do the simplest thing, and what I'll worry about is, let's instead of doing zeros and ones, use A's and B's. It may be the case if you send me AB, AB, or if you prefer 0, 1, 0, 1, that's a little bit of information. I want to know if what you sent me is valid. Well, one way to do that is have a little rule that goes ahead and counts the number of zeros or ones, and indicates whether they're odd or even. So let's do that with respect to B's. And we'll have the property that there'll be an extra character appended on there that will always be sufficient to make sure there's an odd number of B's. So if you had A, B, A, B, well, there's only two of those. How do I know there are two? Well, I've got an automaton that's looking at these bits and counting the number of B's it saw. It'll go ahead and add another B. Now, why is that the case? So you don't really store four characters, you store five. And now what happens if there was an error in transmission? What would happen? It's a situation there that an A would be changed to a B, but notice in this case, I'm expecting an odd number of Bs. If an A is incorrectly changed to a B, I get an even number. If a B is incorrectly changed to an A, I get an even number. So I can tell when things are transmitted that something messed up. And that's the first key to be able to fix it. But you can actually do better than that. Many systems go ahead and have ways of fixing errors. Now, of course, you all know about that situation. You have, you know, databases are your life. And you took a database course on last semester. And all modern databases, except for one particular spot apparently, have redundancy in there. It's called rating. And you know about rating? Many of you do. Essentially, rating says, when I have a copy of a file, I'm going to split it up into pieces and have multiple copies of those spread around the file system, and particularly spread on different devices. So that if, for example, God forbid, do you still have a computing center here where you have a server, computers, and all that in one room? Once upon a time, you did. I went past it, but I don't remember where it was. But almost certainly, you have data stored off campus. Simply that if you had a major fire or earthquake or whatever, the data would not be lost. So that's possible to do there. But it's actually, this happens on the sort of data you store routinely in your computer memory. And there are ways of doing it, but one way of doing it that's easy to represent is by having redundancy. That's exactly what rating does. Suppose I want to find out if I sent you a message like ABAB. And notice, by the beauty of computing, this could be part of a number. It could be a bit of music, a bit of video, a bit of health information. Doesn't matter. It's all represented the same way, and therefore can be handled safely the same way. So here's what will happen on this case. If I have a piece of data like AB, I'm going to make multiple copies. In this case, I'll make two extra copies. By the way, this is not very efficient, but there are more efficient ways of doing it. This is just easy to understand. So I want to send AB, but I want to make sure not only do I find out if it's messed up, I can do that with parity, but I can also repair it. And this is the cool thing. Just imagine, I can have an error made in transmission. In this case, we'll assume it's a single character error, and find out the error was made and fix it. This means I have the potential to do perfect transmission across minor errors. Again, these errors could be something like a little bit of dust on your DVD or a magnetic blip or situation. If you're listening to the sound on radios, you remember the old time with static, you know, that you'd be listening to a game and all of a sudden there'd be a lightning bolt and you'd hear a crackling across your radio. So the way this would work is I would send this. And notice this has the property that if I make one error, the error can be I change an A to a B to an A, or even make it totally unreadable. I can still decipher what you meant, because notice what's going to happen. No matter where that error occurs, I'm going to have two clean copies and one messed up copy. So say I accidentally change this B to an A. When I'm processing this, I go ahead and say, what was here? It should have been three ABs, but of course it doesn't know that as you're sending it. It says, oh, there's an AA, then an AB, and an AB. Well, we take a little vote. Two guys say AB, one guy says AA, he loses, 2-1. And therefore we say, this was just a mess up. What you really sent was AB. So by using automata, and this problem we're going to do talks a little bit about a variation on that, it's able to first find out if your data are mistransmitted and automatically correct minor errors. Now, obviously, with more redundancy, you could do greater errors. There's some things which, you know, are just too great to handle. If any of you have ever left a DVD in a hot car on a sunny day, you know what sometimes happens, you know, situation. I don't know if they have that picture. It's like a Jason Pollock picture where they have a clock that's kind of melting and warped. And that's what happens to DVDs. They start to melt and warp, and that doesn't work out at all well. So that's sort of the background on this. So I'm going to give you half this answer, and I'm going to let you work on the other half. So the first half is, if I write down a number in binary form, can you tell me, by just looking at the bits, whether or not that represents an even integer, positive integer, that is 0, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, etc.? Turns out this is a remarkably easy one to answer, and can anybody tell me how I could tell? I look at the rightmost bit. This one, for example, remember he said this was 6. 6 is even. So by looking at the rightmost bit, it's 0, it's even. If it's 1, it's odd. And that's obviously because the last thing you would add in is a 1 on that, and these would be even, and even plus 1 is odd. So that's an easy one. The answer is look at the rightmost bit. But here's the question is, if I wanted to do something kind of along the lines of this parity or this error correction stuff, and I was going to give you a number that had the property that it had to be evenly divisible by 3, that means it's 0 or 3 or 6 or 9 or 12 or 15, why am I doing 3? Well, we already did 2, and that was pretty easy, so maybe 3 is a little harder or more interesting perhaps. So I want to look at these things and I want to say, if it's evenly divisible by 3, that passed my test. I consider this to be a sound transmission. If it doesn't pass my test, it's not going to be. And notice if I change random bits, it's likely to be the case that if it was evenly divisible by 3, it's not going to be anymore. So you can see the basis for this. So all that we're saying is that the case or not? Maybe it's wishful thinking. Remember, there are some kinds of arithmetic like infinitely large counting that finite automata can't do because of that balanced bracket business. Is the case this true or not? A little bit of a puzzle, you can play with it, and the answer is either yes or no. So flip a coin and no. But if you say yes, you're going to have to say why. You're going to know you're going to have to say why, so it's not quite that easy. But that's the motivation for this. It's not just to drive you crazy, but it's the case that manipulation of bits are oftentimes done at the microprocessor level in what amount to little finite automata. Things like counting bits for parity is a great example. It simply counts the bits and says, did I see an even or an odd number of ones? If it wanted odd and it didn't see it, it says, there's something wrong with this data. And we either go into repair mode or at least go into error mode and say, hey, this transmission was wrong. Maybe you resend it or something. So we have the basic tools there. And one last one. Is a situation that sometimes we have to, again, using this notion that data are sometimes corrupted, sometimes we have to process data that we're not entirely sure is totally valid. Would it be the case, we ask, if I give you a set of what I consider to be tokens, they don't necessarily be tokens, they could be keywords or important terms that I'm looking for. So I'm doing medical sort of things, I'm looking for medical jargon that's particularly important. This might be relevant for, I'm told that certain physicians have terrible handwriting and that you get a prescription or some orders and scribble, 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 and says, did he say to medicate or murder that particular individual, or maybe both, the situation there, I can't tell. Well, could computers help us a little bit? So it's a situation there that I can imagine delete one, and let's look at the definition. It says, we systematically remove the first character from a set of non-null strings. This may be a list of keywords I want, and deleting the first character is the same thing as saying I can't read the first character. That assumes you can read the rest of it. And it turns out, by the way, you can do a similar thing and remove from the right end. Remember we said this business about reading regular expressions forward or backwards, either way. So if this works for delete, I could reverse it and take the last character. Turns out it's slightly harder, but you can also do something where any one character is lost. So you can imagine somebody's writing something out and you say, oh, I can't read that. Is that an O or an E? Or is that an I or a T? You know, if you ever read handwriting that's bad, like mine, you know what I'm talking about. Remember, I'm black writing. If you saw me writing script, you'd really be horrified. Well, it turns out Automata can help us on that. And we want to make sure that this is doable. And in fact, it is. So we're going to situation. You're going to show that if I have a set of terms, reserved words, or if you want, it's possible for me to generate an automaton that anticipates the possibility of a mess up. In this case, it's a fairly minor mess up, namely, the first character is deleted. And we'll assume, again, deleted is unreadable. And it says, from the remainder, can I tell what was there? If there's a set of particular buzzwords that are important, is the remainder of them enough to be recognized? We can have an automaton recognize them and say, okay, yes, I think this could have been this important word with the first letter lost, or maybe that one, or maybe that one. And depending, you know, might be a choice of two or three if the first letter was particularly significant. So that's the notion of here, and that's why I gave you that particular problem. So you're going to say, how would I do that? There are two approaches. One is to say, give me the regular expression, and I'll rewrite it into something that systematically loses the first character. Be careful about that, because regular expressions can be very nasty. They can have lambdas, they can have stars and pluses and nesting and all sorts of things. The alternative is to build an automaton that recognizes R and engineer it, edit it, change it to do something that anticipates the first character being lost and the remainder of the characters being read as per normal. If you can do that, that's your solution. So that's the notion there. Any questions on any of those? Say, oh my gosh, how do I ever get into this class? But actually, it turns out these are useful sort of notions and things that will help us understand more fully what the automata are doing. Get this sucker back to life. Okay. So now we're going to change and go completely from finite automata and regular expressions. I've said the last that I'm going to say about that, and you're saying thank God, so that's good on that. And we're going to go to what actually is a more powerful and more important sort of notation, and that has to do with context-free grammars. So the notion here is going to be, how do we actually specify not just the individual words of a programming language, but how do we specify the actual sequences that are valid? So this is the point where we see what structures are accepted, which ones aren't, and from which we build the abstract syntax tree. Remember, the abstract syntax tree is the actual definitional structure, and we'll build that from the parsing phase, and the parsing phase will be run by context-free grammars. So just as finite automata, and I promise I wouldn't say much about them, but I guess I have to in transition. Just as finite automata had states and transitions, it turns out context-free grammars have two main components. But the good point is one of those you already know about. They're called tokens or terminals in this terminology. What happens is the people that developed the technology of context-free grammars and regular expressions didn't always unify their terminology. So it's rather much like having non-standard notations. And you've all had that. I mean, many of you have probably traveled to Europe or so on, you know, where you don't take an elevator, you have a lift, right? And you don't have a hood of a car, you have a bonnet. Some of them can be a little more tricky. That situation there was President Bush, number one, was visiting Australia. Any Aussies here? Okay, that's probably good, and it is. Anyway, so, you know, and he was, you know, very popular. You know, the Australians are mostly our friends and all that. So he's taking this big ride, you know, in a limousine, and he was very happy. So he was flashing the V for victory sign, just like Winston Churchill. Well, that's fine. I mean, V for victory is not here, but it turns out in Australia, this is not V for victory. Let's say it's closer to what you see in New York City with one digit rather than two. It's like the New York City, we're number one, but with the middle finger rather than the first finger. So here's this poor guy. He's a friend of Australia and they're doing that. And you know, he's of Winston Churchill's generation. You know, President Bush, number one, fought in World War II. He, you know, he was a pilot. He was shot down, awarded a medal and all that. And the Australians appreciated that because the war in the Pacific saved the Australians. Failing that, they would be speaking Japanese today instead of English or Aussie, as they say it is. So he's flashing his we're in a V for victory sign, and people didn't take offense, but somebody called him aside and said to him, no, 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 you don't do that in Australia. So you got to be careful, you know, about terminology. So, but you already know about these. What we call terminals are tokens. And now, remember, we said that the parser and the scanner had to interact. And the way they're going to interact is the parser is going to tap the scanner on the shoulder and say, hey, please give me another token. I'll look at that token using these rules we're about to develop. I'll try to figure out how this fits in to the particular structure. So terminals are tokens. We have non-terminals. And these are just placeholders. And that means that you originally start out and say, at this particular point in a program, I'm expecting a statement or a declaration or a method or an expression or an individual value. I don't know which one the user is going to choose, but at this stage, this is what I expect. So the non-terminals will be named as placeholders with rules that say, here are possible ways to form a statement or a declaration or an expression. So you have non-terminals. You'll have a starting point that's called the start symbol. The start symbol is very much like the start state. It says, at the beginning, we'll have one placeholder that represents the entire program. And guess what? It's oftentimes called program. Or sometimes prog as an abbreviation, or class def, or whatever you have. But something that says, here's, at the beginning, I want to form something that is a program. And finally, we have a set of rules that are called productions. That have a very nice little form. It says one non-terminal, one placeholder. So it says one non-terminal. And an arrow symbol, which says may be expanded to, and a series of zero or more terminals and or non-terminals mixed in any and all orders. Just as we did in regular expressions, we'll be allowed to use lambda. That says goes to nothing. It means I had an option and I chose not to exercise it. I could have had a label. I chose not to put a label on there. You can have a single terminal. So I could have, for example, ID. So it says one of the things this non-terminal could be is a single ID. I usually have some choices, so it may be also an integer or literal. Or, because I have more complex structure, I could have a series of terminals and non-terminals. So another thing I might have is a paren, an expression, which I'll abbreviate expr, and a closed paren. So here's the case where I showed you about closed parens being matched. We said that we couldn't do that in regular expressions, but we can do that in grammars. This would say, I can have an expression enclosed in parentheses. And of course, we use that sometimes to group together how we want an expression to be evaluated or read. Yep. And those are the four parts. Terminals, which we already know about, they're tokens. Non-terminals, which are placeholder symbols. A start symbol, which is one particular non-terminal. And most important of all, are rules of the form, a single non-terminal, an arrow, which means maybe rewritten to or sometimes goes to, and a series of zero or more terminal and or non-terminal symbols in whatever combination we deem appropriate. Now, as you might imagine, we'll typically have more than one rule for a given non-terminal to give you a choice. So, for example, if we had something called a statement, Maybe it's a if statement. Maybe it's a while statement. Maybe it's a print statement. Maybe it's a return statement. And depending on how rich our language is, we may have a number of choices. So what this grammar will do for us is show us precisely what legal sequences are. And more importantly, it'll be able to form a basis to automatically generate a parser, which will take a series of tokens, that is terminals, and say, yes, this is valid because there are rules in this grammar that say how to form this particular structure. Or it'll say, no way, hey, this is illegal. You may not have this structure. It's not legal under our terms. And what's even better about that is it'll point out exactly what the first symbol it sees is that can't possibly be right. So that means if, for example, I was trying to write an expression, A equals B plus C, and I somehow forgot the plus, and I wrote down A equals B blank C. Now, most programming languages don't allow two identifiers next to each other without an intervening operator. C doesn't, Java doesn't, most don't. So the parser would say, hey, okay, that's an identifier. Oh, he's doing an assignment. Oh, there's B. He's doing the beginning of an expression. Uh-oh, another identifier cannot follow a first identifier under our rules. If you wanted to allow that, you could. You'd simply change the rules. But in this stage, you'd say, uh-oh, this is illegal. And it'll be the basis of saying syntax error and point you to that guy. And you're familiar with conventional compilers that take a line and point you to where it is, or something like Eclipse that would highlight what it didn't like and saying, this guy is illegal in this context. Eclipse sometimes even makes suggestions on how to fix it. We'll talk a little bit about that. Sometimes that's an easy fix, sometimes it's not so easy. For example, there's a missing operator. No way I'm going to be able to guess which one it is. I might say, you maybe want an operator here, but which one? I'd have to understand the logic of the program way more than a compiler ever will. So that's the basic structure. Hey, let's look at one now and start actually reading these guys. And before the day is out, or the night is out, we're going to actually see CSX, which is a bit more involved than this. So let me show you how this is read. What happens is typically I have to give you four things: the rules, the terminals, the non-terminals, and the start symbol. This is all I need to show you. Each of the rules is listed. By convention, the very first rule involves the start symbol. Anything that appears on the left-hand side of an arrow is a non-terminal. All the other symbols, other than the arrow itself, are terminals. And in this case, they're very familiar because you've seen these guys as tokens to be scanned by your scanner. And the sequence simply says, here's how they're ordered. So we can read this as saying, what is a program in our language? It's something, this is very similar to CSX Lite, very simple language. It says, well, it's a sequence of statements. Typically, we'll try to take names that are suggestive of the English meaning. So statement is a singleton. Statements with an S is plural. You could spell it out more so if you wanted to. It's always a balance between readability and verboseness. So it says a program is only one thing in this simple language. It's a series of statements delimited by curly braces. What are statements? I have two choices. One way is a statement. Statements can be a single statement. So a program with a single statement is valid. But wait a minute, I want to be able to have more. So it's typically the case that we have recursive productions that allow a rule to be applied more than once. So I have something like that. This means if I want three statements, may I have them? And the answer is yes. I first start out with statements, expand it out using this rule once to that, then expand this a second time, then use the third rule that says statements can be a statement, and all of a sudden I show I can generate three consecutive statements. So a program with exactly three statements is legal. We can actually, now that we can read the grammar a tad, we can answer some questions that otherwise might be befuddling. For example, some programs allow you to have zero statements. Does this grammar allow you to have zero statements as the body of a program? And the answer is no, because there's no lambda symbol that says I can allow a statement to be nothing at all. So in this case, it says you've got to have at least one statement. Why? Because I wrote it that way. If I wanted to, I could simply go ahead and change it by having a rule that says statements goes to lambda. Statements goes to lambda. And at some stage, I could then go ahead and have them disappear. So it's my call, and we'll see that later in our full language. Let's go on a little bit, and it says, well, what is a statement? Well, we have a pretty paltry language. It's only one kind of statement. It looks like the familiar assignment. So ID is a terminal, equal is a terminal, expert is a new non-terminal meant to abbreviate expression. It says, what is an expression? It's an identifier or an expression plus an identifier. So I can create something like A plus B plus C, assuming A, B, and C are scanned as identifiers. So I'll oftentimes write them in the form the scanner would see, but the parser sees not A, B, or C. It sees an identifier with the information inside the token saying, oh, by the way, my spelling is A or B or C. So I have an expression, and it says, what can I be? Well, I could be a single ID, or I could be an expression plus an ID, or this expression could also become plus ID, and then this guy can become an ID. So A plus B plus C is a legal expression. Things that are not formable using these rules are automatically illegal. So, for example, some of you like to put a semicolon at the end of a statement. That was, in the early days of programming, a big concern. You know, you'd write A equals B, semicolon, just like you write a sentence, the quick brown fox jumped over the lazy brown dog, period. And does this language allow you to have the last statement have a semicolon? The answer is no, it doesn't. How could I fix that? Well, as we're going to see, we can do some grammar engineering. Suppose I wanted to have a semicolon at the end of each statement, including the very last one. What I could do is do something that looks odd, say namely statement without the semicolon at line 2. But what I could do is at the end of a statement itself, I could have the semicolon. I could have ID equals expert semicolon. And now I've done a slight change. Now what happens is each time I put down a statement, it has to end in a semicolon, and that includes the very last one. So the difference is some people view semicolons as statement separators. If I have a single statement, I don't need a separator. Other people view it as a statement terminator. If it's the terminator, you know, then it's bad. You don't want to be hit by the terminator. That means you have to have one even if you have a singleton statement. And in some ways, it's a matter of philosophy, of elegance. You know, which way do you do it? Situation, you know, when you drink your tea, do you have your pinky up like they say in society, or you just grab the mug and chug it all down like most people do over here? So the takeaway here is that something as simple as this grammar, and yours is going to be a little bit more detailed, but it's going to be very much this flavor, tells you what's possible and gives you precise answers to little questions of, if I did this, is allowed, disallowed? You can go ahead and change grammars. One of the beauties about having an automatic parser generator is if you change the grammar, you generate a new parser. So Java, for example, has gone through a number of generations, and at each stage they change things slightly. Usually they try to be backward compatible, but in some situations they just add things which previously didn't exist. So I think in the old days, early days, there was a method that you could import from one of the classes called assert. But am I correct now? The latest versions of Java, assert is a statement? I think it is. What the heck is assert? Assert is one of these really cool things. That doesn't do a computation, but is a sanity check. Assert says, I believe this Boolean is true. So you say, assert, the number of my dependents is less than a million. If that's true, I go on. If it's not true, it terminates me and says, hey, wait a minute. You believe something was true, namely, I could not have more than a million dependents. And I did. Why? Well, maybe somebody's doing that fuzz thing I talked about earlier and shipping all kinds of terrible data into your program just to see how robust it is. And if so, then you could say, oh, wait a minute, I cannot handle more than a million. And we have to we have to terminate the program and continue on. Let's see, how are we doing here on time? Oh, we're fine. So, as an alternative in notation, we oftentimes, as I said, have more than one production with the same left-hand side. Typically, we group those together and show alternatives. This OR bar simply is an alternative to having the left-hand side repeated. So this is very much like regular expression notation. It says statements can be this guy or that guy, and typically each alternative is on a separate line. So this is just notational convenience. It's something which JavaCup, our parser generator, will support. So, well, it turns out that we want to not only decide whether a particular token sequence is valid, but we want to put some structure to it. So it turns out we're able, when we have a grammar and an input, to actually go ahead and show the structure behind by actually going through step by step. So this particular case, we start with a program and end up with an actual totally detailed program at the very end, or we can show you step by step. The step-by-step is actually what a parser typically does by verifying that this component is valid, then that, and then that. So we could say, okay, you know that all programs begin with prog, and it's a situation here where this is the input the user gave me. How do I know this input is valid? Well, I can do it two ways. One is I can create valid programs by starting at prog and working my way forward. That's called derivations. And it says, well, there's a rule that says a prog was statements. Each step, I'm going to take one non-terminal and replace it with either a terminal or a new sequence of symbols, including terminals and non-terminals. So it says, what could statements be? It could be a single statement prefixed by additional statements. A single statement can be, a group of statements can be a single statement. So it says, I can have a program with exactly two statements in them. The first statement could be an assignment. In fact, they're all going to be assignments because of this language, involving an expression. And the expression could be a simple ID. The second statement is also an assignment, but it's going to have a more complex expression, ID plus ID. So in this particular case, I'm able to show the derivation, show something of the derivation. What we're going to do when we get around to parsing is actually invert the process. And this is the cool part. We're going to actually devise an algorithm that throws this guy at it to begin with. Remember, this is simply a series of tokens. The parser calls the scanner and says, give me a token, give me a token, give me a token. And this is the sequence it sees. And the parser is going to go ahead and look at the grammar, scratch its virtual head, and work its way backwards. It's going to say, well, we started with this. I bet you this identifier is part of an expression. And it's going to say, I bet you then expression plus identifier was expression, and work its way back up. So that's what it's going to do. Not clear at all how it's going to do it. It's going to take some smarts to get that to work right. But the notion is we can create valid programs by deriving from the start symbol or actually parse programs by starting at terminals and working our way backwards until we get to a particular start symbol or the particular start symbol. An easy way to visualize this is a creation of a tree. And remember, we want to create abstract syntax trees anyway, so this is probably a good idea. You can imagine as we went along, the substructure belonging to a particular component is shown as a subtree. So in this particular case, it says, here's a prog. Well, each of my children in the right-hand side will be a subtree. So a prog is a brace, a non-terminal statements, and another brace. Well, the terminals just stay. That's why they're called terminals. Once I got them, they're there forever. It says statements can be a sequence of statements, semicolon, a single statement. So I've got two subtrees now and a trivial one. A statements can be a single statement, which can be an assignment. An expert can be an ID. Or statements can be another assignment. An expert involving two identifiers and that. So this is what's called the parse tree. And implicitly, a parser builds a parse tree as it goes along, because what it does is it solves the program subtree by subtree. If I have a huge program, it's not going to solve it all at once. It's going to do bit by bit by bit. And moreover, once it discovers this tree exists, it can create what we actually have, namely an abstract syntax tree, by throwing away some of the unnecessary symbols. The notion here is that if a symbol doesn't really have any meaning for the translation of a program beyond being a delimiter or a grouper, why keep it in the tree? The tree gets unnecessarily larger and wastes space and has additional complexity. It's also possible in this case to show a little bit of the structure for translation. So in this case, what have we lost? Let's go back. Notice the braces are gone. Go forward. There are no braces. Why? Well, braces were there for human readership. You had to have a brace at the beginning, had to have a brace at the end, but so what? They don't do anything because they're always there. If all programs have them, I don't have to differentiate by showing they existed. Similarly, there's no semicolon. Why? Semicolon separated one statement from another, but wait a minute, the subtree business does that. The one statement is this subtree, the other statement is that subtree. Similarly for an expression, it says, well, what's an expression like addition? It's a binary operation that has two subtrees, the left operand and the right operand. What's an assignment? It's a statement that has two subtrees, the source of the assignment and the target of the assignment. So it's gone ahead and restructured this program into something much closer to what we expect when we understand the program. So we'll build not just a parse tree, but an abstract syntax tree. That's the thing we gave you, or I gave you, for the very first assignment that you walked to do some determination. So where the heck did that tree come from? It came from the parser building the abstract syntax tree as it read tokens and figured out their structure. So as I was showing you a moment ago, we can go ahead and drive a program step by step. This funny looking double arrow says, I can go from this structure to the next structure by applying exactly one production. The difference here is that the things on the left no longer are single non-terminals. Read this as, here's what I have so far. I can extend it by adding the effect of one more production. So in this case, it says, prog turned out to be a list of statements delimited by braces. Statements turned out to be at least two statements separated by a semicolon, and now exactly two statements. The first was an assignment. The expression in that assignment was a single ID. Then the second statement is also an assignment. Its expression has two identifiers. And finally, we end up with this. Sometimes I don't want to show the intermediate steps, so this little superscript plus is exactly the same thing as we had in regular expressions. It says by applying one or more productions, I can go all the way from prog to that particular list of terminal symbols. And that's a way of saying this is a valid program. I know it's valid structurally, because I started out with prog, and using just the valid productions, I was able to create that particular output. In some cases, a parser cares about the order in which non-terminals are rewritten, and it turns out there are two traditional ways of creating a parse. One is called the left parse, and the left parse simply says, whenever I have more than one non-terminal, I'll always rewrite the leftmost non-terminal. That kind of makes sense if we imagine a program being processed left to right. So here, for example, I had two non-terminals, but I'm going to completely expand statements, first to a statement, then to an assignment, then to the identifiers in the expression, before I ever start touching the next one. That's called leftmost parse, and it says leftmost rewrite. And in fact, we'll develop a parser that generates a leftmost parse by essentially discovering this derivation sequence. What's less obvious, but still there, we can use this notation. And this just clarifies that as we're deriving a program, the sub L means we're always guaranteeing the leftmost symbol will be rewritten. So this just simply expands the notation. But less obviously, you can have a rightmost derivation. This thing seems kind of strange because a rightmost derivation says the rightmost non-terminal, the one farthest from the left end, is the one that's rewritten. And you say, well, why would any sane person care about that? Guess what? It's because the parser we're going to use in JavaCup does exactly that. It seems kind of odd that it would work that way, and we'll explain technically why it is. But it essentially discovers a parse, But it does it by essentially handling the rightmost symbol first and working its way upward from the right to the left instead of from the left to the right. So it does it in reverse order. It's kind of difficult to believe any sane technology would do it that way, but it works out that this is a good way of doing things. And in fact, rightmost parsers are more powerful than leftmost parsers. Now, why in the world would that be the case? Well, there's a nice analogy I like to use. It's a situation there that sometimes they have sporting events and have them at Camp Randall or Lambeau Field or other places. And I'm sure none of you would ever do this, but I've heard rumors that people actually put monetary expectations on the outcome of the game. Okay. Now, the rules, as I understand it, is typically you have to have your money down before the game begins. That's kind of like the leftmost parse. But suppose I was allowed to wait a little longer, like until halftime, or until the beginning of the fourth period, or to the two-minute warning. That would make it a lot easier to pick the winner, except if you're seeing the NFC championship game. And when was the final score done? How many seconds left? Pretty close to the end of the game. That was terrible. I mean, who would have believed they could drop that much of a lead? But yeah, that's life it is. So it turns out the reason that this parsing technique is used is because when I have a hard decision, like who's going to win and who's going to lose, I can wait much, much longer into the game before I have to make a decision. So the technology is such that if I'm allowed to wait, the rightmost derivation is the one I want to use. If I have to put up my money immediately, make my prediction before the game even begins, which is unfortunately the way most bettors are forced to do it, I can go ahead and do a leftmost derivation as the analog. So we have rightmost derivation. Now let's look at the difference. And here's what I'm talking about here. Notice here, when I get to two non-terminals, it's the rightmost that's getting expanded, then expr, then expr plus ID. So notice this whole right end here is solved before I ever get to this statement. Then I work on this one, and it's always the rightmost symbol being reduced. So again, it's clear that that could in theory work. It's not clear why we'd want to do it, but later on the technology will force us in that direction. Well, grammars are definitions, and in theory, definitions ought to be precise. It's a situation where people always expect that if you have something like tax law or criminal law or civil law, it'll be absolutely clear what's going on. Because now this is tax season, and there are famous stories about people who have large incomes going to tax attorneys, and each tax attorney you go to has a different expectation of what your tax return ought to be in terms of how much you owe or how much you get back. It's a situation there that you would expect grammars. What do? They don't decide how much taxes you have. They decide whether or not a program means this or that. Well, it's possible to write down rules. They're fairly sloppy rules. Huh? What the heck is that? Oh, some of my voice is going through on this. Sorry about that, guys. Oh, it's over. Okay. I think I have one of my web pages coming to life unexpectedly. Oh, I didn't want that. Didn't want that. Come on, guys. Let me kill that. I was listening to the weather report before I came over, and they finally made me pay for it. That's one of the negative things about computing environment there. They're always trying to market new ways of doing things. Amen. Well, we've covered a lot today. Yes, so before I got rudely interrupted by that commercial, it's possible usually through sloppiness, although I'll show you an example where it's sometimes forced upon you by convention, to create a grammar that has a non-unique specification of the structure of a program, and that's normally bad. So here's a case that looks like it ought to work, but doesn't work as well as we would hope. This is an expression where I'm trying to do subtraction. Now, subtraction is a little different than addition because in addition, assuming that computer arithmetic were perfect, the order in which you do additions doesn't matter. So mathematically, but not computer-wise, A plus B plus C could be evaluated left to right or right to left. When you're doing actual computer calculations, it may make a difference for either overflow or for rounding errors. But in terms of subtraction, it makes a much bigger difference. If I say, well, let's pick this up then after our next break. We'll take that about 8 o'clock, and we'll finish up on this, and then we'll get to the actual CSX grammar and how it works.